I'm Alan Alexandroff, and I'm the director of the Global Cemetery Project. The work we have been undertaking at the Global Cemetery Project can be found at globalcemeteryproject.com. It is my pleasure today to invite back into the virtual studio our good colleague, Stuart Patrick. This podcast is Summit Dialogue Season 2, Episode 4, and I'm going to be discussing with Stuart the Summit of the Future. This is a UN summit that will occur in September to this year. The origins of this summit actually start with the 75th anniversary of the UN in 2020 and the call for the Secretary General of the UN to prepare recommendations for the future. And he in turn prepared a report, Our Common Agenda. Among the many recommendations that the Secretary General proposed was the convening of a Summit of the Future. The General Assembly then decided that the Summit of the Future would take place in September 2024. Now, this summit, of course, follows from an earlier summit, which took place in September 2023 at the convening of the UN in September of that year. And this was the SDG summit, which was a focus on progress that had been made, or lack of progress that had been made, in achieving the Agenda 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. Then the hope for the Summit of the Future was that it would result in an intergovernmentally negotiated, action-oriented pact for the future. So there we have it. Let me reintroduce briefly Stuart Patrick. He's a senior fellow and director of the Global Order and Institutions Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Primary areas of his research are shifting foundations of world order, future of American internationalism, and the requirements for effective multilateral cooperation on a variety of transnational challenges. So Patrick has written three books: The Sovereignty Wars, Weak Links, and The Best Laid Plans: The Origins of American Multilateralism and the Dawn of the Cold War. He's produced many articles, essays, chapters, reports on the problems of world order, U.S. global engagement, and the United Nations, and the management of global issues. So it's with great pleasure that I invite back into the virtual studio my colleague and friend, Stuart Patrick. So, welcome, Stuart. It's a pleasure to have you back in here at the virtual studio.
It's great to be with you, Alan.
Great. So, today we're talking the Summit of the Future and the various reports as well. And so, I wanted to then put us in the picture for this. We start, of course, Stuart, with the 75th anniversary of the UN. And a call for the Secretary General to prepare recommendations for the future, not surprisingly. And he prepared a report. It's called Our Common Agenda. Among the recommendations, the Secretary General proposed Summit of the Future. The General Assembly then decided, okay, we'll have this Summit of the Future, and it'll take place in September 2024. And of course, it's supposed, if I understand correctly, it's supposed to build on the first summit, which was the SDG summit that the UN held last September. And that this summit, the Summit of the Future, the outcome would be an intergovernmental negotiated action-oriented, so the UN says, pact for the future. So, Stuart, today we appear to have two universes. The first is the zero draft, the pact of the future draft prepared by the member states. And then we also have many recommendations from the Secretary General and various reports prepared for the Summit of the Future. So these appear to be rather separate universes, that is the Pact of the Future and all these other reports from the Secretary General. What does this tell us about the prospects of reform in the upcoming period, Stuart?
Well, yeah, absolutely. As you mentioned, just in terms of the genesis of this, as you mentioned, that, you know, a lot of this is coming out of the 75th anniversary of the United Nations. And you know, right. Miraculously, they even got the United States under the Trump administration to endorse, you know, dozen odd principles, very important principles of international cooperation, and really to, in a sense, try to revive, in a sense, the UN Charter and international commitments to it. But in the aftermath of that, as you rightly point out, the Secretary General had came out with this report, Our Common Agenda, and then created this, again, a dozen odd policy briefs of incredible detail about with many, many proposals about how the multilateral system could be revived. Then, in preparation for the Summit of the Future, there was a draft created of the Pact for the Future, which that came out in late January, I believe, and it's under the pen of the permanent representatives of Germany and Namibia as the two holding the pen. And it was, I have to say, it was a little bit of a disappointment because it was very general and, had a number of principles that it articulated, but there was much more, as you point out, it was much more about the what than the how. The Secretary General was a lot more about the how to get this done, or at least here were the ways to move forward. The document itself, which was about 20 pages, and it has now morphed into sort of a 240-page, with the inputs of member states, has morphed into this sort of 240-page behemoth that the governments are now sort of trying to negotiate and go through line by line, and are making some significant progress. But the initial 20-page document had 39 reaffirms and not a single we decide. And just to get to your point, and it had a number of general principles, but it was not a bold document that really meets the moment, because obviously there are these centrifugal and centripetal forces that the world is confronting right now, with geopolitical rivalry and climate change and major regression on the SDGs, etc. And yet the document was quite generic, and which was disappointing because often you understand that at the United Nations things get boiled down often to the lowest common denominator, but you want to start with a high ambition document and sort of define it down if that needs to happen, as opposed to the reverse. So I think that the negotiators have their work cut out for them, because they in a sense have to take a document that was already relatively banal and try to pump it up a little bit, and that's hard to do among 193 member states, to say the least.
I can well imagine. So let's just point to one thing, because you and I focused on it in previous circumstances. This is Security Council reform. In the initial document, the Pact for the Future, and notwithstanding there's been longstanding kind of calls and efforts for Security Council reform, that is, who's in it and veto and all the rest of it. In fact, they were actually able to produce any provision at all. They just simply kind of put a marker there and said, it is clear with member states and stakeholder inputs that reform remains a priority, but no reform. I mean, is that is that really, you know, that tells us something rather dramatic given how important others have pointed to in terms of Security Council reform.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a major lacuna, major gap in the current, in the at least the initial draft, was the basically the silence on that topic. And I should say that it's particularly disappointing because there was at least a glimmer of possibility that there might be some forward movement on this. You know, the negotiations have on Security Council reform have been sort of trapped in the aptly named open-ended working group on Security Council reform, because these have been going on for decades, these discussions, and they're mostly involved the rearticulation or repetition of well-known block positions on the actual topic. And according to the folks in the know, in terms of the current version of the Pact for the Future on this topic, there is a sense that they need to wait until the most the latest session of these intergovernmental negotiations at least comes up with a recommendation of what kind of language would be put in this pact. So they're waiting. My assumption is that the final pact for the future will at least have some more detailed language than just we all agree that the Security Council needs to be reformed. That said, I mentioned the glimmer of hope that had emerged partly as a result of the Biden administration's position. President Biden in September of 2022, you might remember, at the UN General Assembly, surprised some folks by, for the first time, committing the United States not only to inclusion of the usual suspects in terms of the Security Council enlargement, and in this case, the usual suspects in terms of folks that the United States had previously endorsed, the countries Germany and Japan, of course, and then also more recently India, not yet Brazil, still three of the four major countries in the so-called G4 that have been pushing for permanent membership. But President Biden said not only would we endorse those, but we also, the United States is in favor of permanent membership, not naming the countries, for Latin America and for Africa. And it was the first time that a U.S. administration had done that. And so it revived interest in the possibility that at least the United States might not be obstructionist and might be able to conceive of a Security Council that was sort of large enough to accommodate new members, both elected and permanent. And yet what has happened, unfortunately, is that there has been, it seems to me, there has been very little follow up on the part of the United States in that. So, you know, there are still three very well known blocks when it comes to UN Security Council reform, the G4 and their allies, their regional rivals, the so-called Uniting for Consensus bloc, so the Pakistans of the world, who of course would not want India, or Argentina, who would not want Brazil, etc. And then of course there's the African bloc, which is locked into a quite maximalist position. But you could imagine a path forward where the G4 and their allies reach common ground with the African Union and its very ambitious position, and you could see at least some sort of movement towards a General Assembly resolution. The difficulty, of course, would be China in particular's staunch opposition to any new permanent membership. But getting back,
sorry, to the G, the G4,
the G, the, yeah, sorry, the, yeah, the G4 are the four main aspirants to permanent membership in the Security Council. That is Germany, Japan, India and Brazil, which have often harmonized their positions and tried to work with countries to get them to agree to their candidacies. The difficulty has always been that among others, that not only do they face regional rivals, but they also faced a united African bloc that insists on two permanent members, again, unnamed, and three elected members. So quite an ambitious agenda. But if those two sides could find common ground, then they might be able to at least increase momentum within the broader UN membership. Mm-hmm.
And I know your colleague, Minthu Pham, had written about this. I guess the other element, just so we kind of complete the picture, where are they sitting, you know, G4 or larger entrants here. Where are they sitting on the issue of veto? Are they, have they eliminated it, or what are they doing?
Yeah. And what's interesting is that the there's actually been some flexibility on the part of most of the G4 membership, Germany, Japan, Brazil in particular, on some flexibility in the veto. India is less comfortable having sort of giving up this notion of having a veto.
I see.
The others are willing to accept at least a transition to having the veto itself. The African Union right now, at least so far, is staunchly in favor of any permanent members from Africa having a veto, as long as the veto exists for other players. But the other big problem with the African Union position is that they have not bitten the bullet to actually choose which two of several aspirants on the African continent. So it kind of replays the same dynamics at a regional level as to, you know, who might be the actual representatives of permanent representatives.
Yeah.
So, but getting back to the Pact of the Future, you know, this is the tightest of all Gordian knots, and it's unclear to me that the Pact of the Future will even have offered two alternative solutions, more elected members or some mixture of more permanent members and elected members. You know, at a minimum, the Pact needs to offer that sort of a choice, because, you know, otherwise, it's a retreat and a regression from, you know, the last big effort to have a summit like this under Kofi Annan back in 2005.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let me turn you to, at least for the moment, the high-level advisory board on effective multilateralism, as you said, the HLAB, right? They produced a significant report. This is a report that was chaired by Alan Johnson Sirleaf, the former president of Liberia, and Stefan, I'm not sure I can pronounce his name correctly, but Lufin, who is the former prime minister of Sweden. And what we find here, lots of recommendations, but one struck me in particular, and this was one of the identified goals for effective multilateralism, and this was to expand the network nature of the United Nations, right? And in the report, they recommend bringing constellations of states and non-state actors together to achieve goals. And the question then becomes, you know, how enthusiastic are the member states to incorporate sub-state, non-state actors into the system when they still seem to be struggling to try to provide the shape for things like what we've just talked about, the Security Council membership, the Security Council reform. So is there any enthusiasm here on member states to expand out and include the kind of non-state actors that are being viewed in this particular segment of the HLAB?
Yeah, I mean, it's a perennial question as to how much voice should be given to non-governmental organizations at the United Nations. And before I get to that, I'll just back up and say, I think that the idea of networked multilateralism, because you also mentioned different constellations of states, I think, you know, part of the whole Summit of the Future is an effort to try to revive and reaffirm the centrality of the United Nations. Obviously, it's you know, fundamental charter principles, but then also its centrality in the multilateral system. And I think that the High Level Advisory Board on body on effective multilateralism was was based, and also the Secretary General's talk about, you know, effective network multilateralism, was recognizing that the UN needs to actually deal with the fact that increasingly multilateralism takes lots of different forms. The first is really multilateralism. I mean, one of the big questions at last year's General Assembly, particularly when Joe Biden was the only head of state or government of the P5, the permanent five members of the Security Council, actually, you know, deigned to show up at the opening of the UN General Assembly, led a lot of people to wonder, wow, what is the relevance of this body compared to, you know, the G20 or the BRICS or any sort of the G7 and the broader Western alliance, et cetera. So I think part of this is the Secretary General's desire to say, yes, there are all these other bodies and we welcome them. We welcome regional organizations too. But basically the main kind of fulcrum and platform needs to remain the UN, the universal UN. That's one aspect, this network multilateralism. The second, though, as you point out, is, you know, non-governmental organizations and private actors. And I think, you know, increasingly global governance, as you know, is about not just, you know, the GX world where you have just mini lateralism, your phrase about bringing, you know, a varying number of sovereign state actors together, but also, you know, bringing it's multi-stakeholderism. You have to bring the non-governmental organizations and service providers in, sometimes along with the private sector. And you see this in the global health arena, you see it in the humanitarian affairs arena. There's also, you know, you see it in efforts that govern artificial intelligence. The problem is, as you point out, a lot of member states just are not enthusiastic about this at all, because they see it as a, you know, an infringement on, you know, their sovereign prerogatives as the member states of the United Nations. And I think it's particularly a problem for sort of more closed societies or authoritarian states. Mm-hmm. But even for democracies, particularly those from the what is called the Global South, I think a real problem with it is that a lot of times those non-state, non-governmental actors are, you know, the ones that can actually have the capacity to attend are all based in the global north, right? And so there's a question of sort of the legitimacy and representativeness of having networked multilateralism, because it's not always clear that the NGOs that are present actually represent, you know, the constituencies in all parts of the world in an equivalent way. So, you know, it does bang up against this this notion of sovereignty, and also, you know, who should be making decisions. Because, you know, the question is, who the heck elected you in terms of the NGOs that might be, you know, making decisions that affect the world?
Yeah, no. Well, exactly. And I mean, here you are struggling to open up the system to, as you say, the global south and, you know, developing emerging market countries, etc. And here at the same time, you're saying, well, but let's invite into the tent all these other interests. And that, it seems to me, a real tension there in terms of understanding reform. So Let me take you then to there seems to be a fair bit of urging and writing about international financial architectural reform. And, you know, I'm assuming in the Pact of the Future, what they're talking about is you know, reform, presumably, World Bank, IMF, I don't know if it extends to the WTO, but the question becomes, and I understand that the UN sees itself at the central nature of the UN, but where does the UN kind of come in on these institutions, which, you know, are not in fact part of the UN system?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question and a very, very controversial topic. The Secretary General Antonio Guterres has made one of his major points of emphasis, in addition to climate change, has been the need for what he calls a new Bretton Woods moment, saying international financial architecture needs to be totally overhauled because it's not representative. It was created when at least the IMF and the World Bank and the were created at a time when, you know, the majority of current UN member states were colonies, or not really involved in those discussions at Bretton Woods. And so, and there's been over time some relatively modest modification of those governing bodies, et cetera. But, you know, they're not necessarily representative anymore, and they're also not necessarily fit for purpose, because even though their mandates have evolved and expanded, sometimes even had mission creep in the view of some, they don't necessarily meet the moment in terms of climate change and many other things. So there's a sense that there needs to be these institutions, like much of the multilateral architecture, needs to be fit for purpose, and need to be their governance needs to change. And so that's why you've seen, and you have seen, a number of efforts within those institutions themselves. And, you know, Kristalina Georgieva, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, she herself has also talked about the need for Bretton Woods 2.0. Yes. And so the question is, you know, who would be at the table, and what would those institutions look like if you could reinvent them? I'll go into some of the institutional reform efforts that have been launched within the World Bank and the IMF, or at least have been proposed for them. But the big controversy, as you're alluding to, is, you know, is the UN the setting to really engage on the reinvention of global financial architecture? Well, certainly the United States and a number of other major powers have been a little bit skeptical about this, thinking that, you know, the decisions on the future of the IMF and the World Bank, for instance, will be decided in Washington, not by the U.S. government solely, but within the governing boards of those bodies at their headquarters. Yep. And of course, you know, there is a system of weighted voting there, rather than sort of a one state, one vote aspect that you would get within the UN. And, you know, one of the Secretary General's main recommendations to try to make a more equitable global financial system is to, you know, elevate, for instance, the Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC, and calling for sort of an annual meeting of ECOSOC with, for instance, the Bretton Woods institutions. Now, you're right that the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the Fund, are not they have some independence from the UN, but they are often considered parts of the broader UN system, notwithstanding their different governance structure. So there's some debate as to whether or not the UN really has has, in a sense, the authority to or the standing to talk about international financial architecture. If one were being more charitable, I think that the Secretary General would probably respond that, look, this isn't about the UN taking over global international finance. This is about the UN being a platform where world leaders come every year, and as sovereign states. So if they're coming as sovereign states, this is a good place to discuss the future of global international financial architecture, even if those decisions will ultimately be taken in Washington. So it's not necessarily, and then the UN officials have repeatedly said this, look, this is not our effort to try to, you know, control international financial architecture, or, you know, to, you know, move into other people's portfolios. But it is an effort to try to influence the debates that are ongoing. And as you know, there have been big debates and big reform proposals. One of them is the Bridgetown agenda or initiative, which was spearheaded by Mia Motley, the Prime Minister of Barbados. That's right. There's also been effort, and that has had kind of some traction, but not nearly as much of a positive response as the champions of that agenda would have wanted, in terms of increasing the scale of global financing for development. For instance, you know, harnessing the special drawing rights in the IMF and recycling those to be able to vastly increase the amount of development funding for developing countries. Loss and damage fund is another big thing that was which has been discussed and approved, but, you know, so far woefully underfunded. So the scale of financing has not really been there. There have been some interesting efforts on the part of the World Bank under the leadership of Ajay Banga to try to increase coordination amongst multilateral development banks. And there's something called the Evolution Roadmap for World Bank reform. So there are things going on. The question is whether or not this Summit of the Future is really a place that's going to be able to handle those effectively.
Yeah, and I guess the question, I turn it back to you. Do you think this is likely? I mean, given the huge menu that has been generated, I'm not sure that it will receive the kind of attention that you've just, you know, kind of pointed to.
Yeah, I think that, you know, at best there, from the UN's perspective, there will be some generic agreement within the Pact for the Future that there needs to be better, larger financing, and there needs to be, you know, leveraging of the massive dollars within the private sector. What you won't see, I think, is any, which a lot of countries in the developing world, the global South, would prefer, which is we want to have firm commitments of a particular target in terms of funding. And that's something that I think that the major donor countries will certainly resist, the Western countries in particular. I don't think you're going to see that, and you won't see commitments to any sort of definitive governance reform of those institutions. But you might see something about ECOSOC, but I'm not sure that you're going to get the sort of notion of a more sort of elevated coordinating role for ECOSOC and the global financial art.
Right.
Yeah.
And they also raise this notion of an emergency institution, to take into account really challenging global, crises that might emerge and could then be called on to intersect with the problem, whatever that problem happens to be. Is that, again, this just seems to me to be an enormous leap, given where the UN currently is.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of ambiguity behind this emergency platform. The Secretary General, the instinct is in a sense laudable, right? Experience of the pandemic, which was not a sort of a traditional security challenge that would be under the purview of the UN Security Council, at least not as currently envisioned. This notion of an emergency platform would offer the Secretary General the opportunity and give him the authority to convene an emergency platform, emergency mechanism with member states and other international organizations to try to spearhead a response. And it sounds a little bit like, an UN equivalent of FEMA, right? That there's an emergency and the question would be, I think, well, it's ambiguous, I guess I would say, as to what falls within the scope of this emergency platform. What constitutes an emergency? How global does it have to be for the SG to do this? And is there sufficient appetite amongst UN member states to give the UN that kind of convening authority that some might think would impinge upon their national sovereignty again? So partly it's, how much do you want the Secretary General to be secretary, and how much do you want the Secretary General to be general? And I think that many member states would prefer to have the Secretary General be more secretary than
Secretary General. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Not the general part.
Right. Exactly.
Well, I guess, looking at the UN and its efforts to, develop this new governance mechanisms, it does seem to me that one of the problems is you take a look at the first summit, which was the summit focused on the sustainable development goals and the desire to achieve those goals by 2030. And, what was the report that was produced was that a mere 12% of the sustainable development goals are currently on track, or as the, nearly 50% of the targets are moderately or severely off track, and around 30% of the targets have stagnated or regressed below the 2015 timeline. So, I mean, it's a, you know, kind of this weather report does not look pretty good. And I guess that, but the question is, I mean, if you look at that, it's not so much the UN, it's the national governments. And that's, you know, in effect, that's where the focus is. And it seems to me that, you know, there's real question marks around the willingness of the national governments, in particular, in this case, to achieve the SDGs, but more generally, to open up a greater role for the UN itself.
Yeah, there are two aspects of your question that I like to focus on. One is about the states themselves in terms of their and the question of governance and the quality of governance in those countries. And then the second is really about whether the crisis of multilateralism is about the crisis of the machinery, or is it about a crisis of the actors?
Right.
Let me take the first one first. I think that you know, much of the dialogue around the SDGs from the perspective of countries in the global South tends to be about you know, sort of give us the tools and we'll finish the job, right? And and I think that, you know, there's no question that with access to greater debt relief, for instance, or access to certain technologies, that development could go much, much better, and that more of the SDGs could be met. But it's also true that, that increasingly some of the poorest folks in the world are concentrated in developing fragile states, countries where governance is dysfunctional, either because of the venality of the governing regime, or the fact that you know, there could be a number of different factors that have a lack of capacity in those countries. So one of the big challenges going forward, and this is reflected in SDG 16, which is kind of a grab bag of governance and security and those types of and conflict, those types of issues. One of the big challenges is as development gets increasingly concentrated in the countries whose governments either refuse to or cannot meet the basic functions of governance, how does the development community respond? So I think that's the first part of your question is very important, because it's really about trying to improve the capacity of states that are fragile, or if they lack the will to do the right thing, how can one work around them, perhaps working with civil society to help advance development in those very difficult circumstances. And that's a real hard nut for the development assistance community to crack. The second issue, which is, I think permeates more the entire notion of this summit of the future and the Pact for the Future, is that there is this overall assumption that, you know, we can create the machinery to make this world work better, and that we just make the institutions fit for purpose, everything will be fine. But I think the reality is also in many cases that the problem lies with the member states and the conduct of the member states and the fact that they're not living up to their obligations under the UN Charter. And, you know, Exhibit A, of course, would be Russia. It's hard to imagine that any of the things that are currently being discussed on peace and security or on human rights, which I should say is a little too underplayed in the current draft of the Pact for the Future, that anything that is said there will have any bearing on Russian behavior globally right now. A similar thing could be said, you know, about China. There's a parallel process going on here with the Pact for the Future in the digital world. There's a global digital compact being prepared, and then also the Secretary General has yet another high-level advisory body on artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the AI front, there's been a lot of multilateral movement to say, hey, we need to have safety be priority, and we need, you know, we want to have a lot of auspicious adjectives influence our AI policies, like human-centered and responsible and safe. That's all well and good, but but you can get China to sign up, for instance, to those nice adjectives. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to imagine that the United States and the West would have the same attitudes about the human-centered export of, you know, surveillance technologies around the world. and so I think that, this is just another example of how you can have a lot of highfalutin principles, but if there are certain actors that are not obeying them, and I don't want to leave the West off the hook in terms of always abiding by the UN Charter, mm-hmm. There are a lot of cases where we have not. But you have to wonder whether or not this effort from the UN Secretariat to, in a sense, deal with the infrastructure and the of international cooperation is missing maybe a little bit of the geopolitics. If the geopolitical situation is dire, then mm-hmm. the future will not look bright, regardless of what happens at the summit.
Well, Stuart, I want to thank you. I mean, it's quite the interesting package. And I think, we need to circle back to you after September to see, in fact, what has occurred and where the UN is going after the completion of the Summit of the Future.
Yeah, one thing I would say that I think is important is that this should not be seen as one and done. I think that the Secretary General would be wise to frame this as the beginning of a longer process. It is a summit of the future and a pact for the future. And there are a lot of things in there that are quite laudable. I should mention that there's going to be a declaration on future generations and
yes,
the duty and responsibilities that current generations owe to the more than 10 billion people that will be born during this century who are not yet born. And there are a number of things that can be launched. I think that the Secretary General recognizes that there are many parallel processes going on and that the UN needs to, in a sense, plug into those. Mm-hmm. But this is not going to be, a big something that you tie a bow on and will answer all of it. It's not going to be a deus ex machina, right? It's going to be the launching of a number of initiatives that will unfold, in subsequent years. I think that to the degree that the UN wants to make this as much of a success as possible, they should really focus on the fact that this is about the future and this is just the beginning of the future.
Just the beginning. So it's an open-ended process, not a, we've done the Summit of the Future. Thank you very much. And now on to other things. Well, again, thank you, Stuart. I mean, it's a fascinating, broad area that needs to be looked at. And I appreciate all your insights into it. And as I said, one of the things we should be doing is coming back to you after the Summit of the Future to see where the future is.
Well, that's great. It's always a great pleasure talking to you, Alan. And I look forward to it.